You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Katzmann, and talking about what remains probably the most captivating division race in baseball. You know, we've seen the AL East get out of hand with the Orioles. We've seen the Angels starting to lap the A's and the AL West, but the one AL race that looks like it's going to go down to the wire is in the Central between a Tigers team that's kind of been there, done that, and the Royals team trying to get there for the first time. And you've seen it when they play head-to-head. The Tigers have had the advantage head-to-head, and you wonder if that veteran confidence is really taken over in those situations. I also wonder which team has more pressure on them as they go down the stretch, the Tigers, who have that World Series or bust mentality, or the Royals, who have almost 30 years of being unable to get to October, kind of hovering over their heads. So that's an interesting division battle, and we're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about the other teams in the Central, the Indians, the Twins, and the White Sox, with the respective beat reporters for MLB.com. So thanks for tuning in. Here we go. I'm going to be joined by Dick Cagle, the Royals beat writer for MLB.com. And the Royals have really being tested here in the September stretch run, where you load up on those division rivals, and obviously their biggest rival right now, the Detroit Tigers, who took the series in Detroit, and then two teams will meet each other again December 19th to 21st in Kansas City. But let's bring in DK to talk about that those head-to-head games, because they've been a struggle for Kansas City. As great as this season has gone for them, as great a story as they've been, as much as they challenged the Royals and in the Central standings, they've struggled, challenged the Tigers in the Central standings. They've really struggled against them when they meet head-on. Tigers took 11 of the first 15 in those matchups this season. And DK, I mean, is it fair to ask, or do you get any sense, or are the Tigers in the Royals' head in any way? Is that a fair question at this point?
Well, the Royals really had problems with them. Which is odd, because last year they actually won the season series against the Tigers and played them very well. And I don't know what the heck's going on this year. They're just not playing the crisp games that we're used to seeing from the Royals when they meet the Tigers. Now, of course, you know, as Alec Garden pointed out, Alec said, well, you know, this is a good team. They got some thumpers and they got some good pitching. And that's why the Royals have had such problems with them this year. But I don't know. Whenever they have seen the Tigers this year, their wanted defense seems to develop some holes as well. So I don't know what the heck's going on. But they got the series coming up in Kansas City, as you said, on September 19th. And Ned's looking ahead to that already. Ned Yost, he's got his veteran pitchers all lined up to start that series, as he has in Detroit, with Guthrie, Vargas, and Shields all at least penciled in at this moment to pitch in that series. So he's looking ahead and wanting very badly to beat these Tigers.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because obviously a young arm like Yordano Ventura is really finishing the season strong, but there is something to be said for that veteran savvy that obviously the Tigers possess in spades, and the Royals possess it more on the bench side offensively, but certainly in the pitching department with guys like Guthrie and Vargas. You know, this is their time to step up and shine. But getting back to that rotation, DK, the big news this past week obviously was Danny Duffy left his start in the Bronx after one pitch with rotator cuff inflammation. You always hate to hear about that, but the good news was they're structurally sound. So it doesn't look like he's headed to the surgeon's table or anything like that. But the bad news is that at a time where, you know, of the utmost import, where you really need this guy, he's got to skip a start and hope that an inflammation calms down. What's your overall sense of the severity of that injury and Duffy's chances of impacting this club down the stretch?
Well, as you say, it's hard to tell at this point, because I talked to Danny just the other day when he was in Kansas City and after his examination. And, he's pretty upbeat about it. Of course, disappointed, of course, that he's going to have to miss at least one start. The problem is right now there's inflammation there, and I think it's rather, as Dayton Moore said, a severe inflammation. So they're going to have to get that out of there, and then Danny's going to have to pick up a baseball in the next few days and try to throw and see how it feels. So that's all going to take a few days and some time, and whether or not he'd be able to take the start after his scratch start here, I don't know. It's hard to tell. Danny doesn't know. The medical people don't really know. They're just going to have to wait. It's going to be time, and you can't really say at this point that Danny, you know, is going to play a significant role as we go down the stretch. It's just too early to tell that. But as you said, the news initially, at least, was good. There's no structural damage, and that's good for Danny, for sure. Whether it's going to impact the club in the final days of the stretch run, we don't know yet.
Yeah. How would you put into words Duffy's impact on this season? A guy who was bidding for a rotation job in spring training, and I think really disappointed a lot of people with the Royals with his performance in spring and didn't make the rotation at that point, but obviously worked his way into it early in the season and really got thrust into a prominent role. So how do you put in the words just his development as the course of this year has gone on?
Yeah, Danny's really had a great year, and I think the whole thing, Anthony, is that Danny has matured very rapidly this year. He was, and still is, of course, a very intense competitor, but I think he sometimes let his intensity overcome reality, if you will, his approach to the game. He took every pitch, so seriously, and if it didn't go exactly right, he fretted and get to him a little bit. But he, through the intervention, I think, of James Shields and some of the other veteran guys on the staff, he's learned to relax a little bit out there, to go with the flow a little more, not put so much stock in just every pitch. You know, if that one doesn't go well, come back with another one that's a little better, maybe. And he's... He's really changed his whole, I think, kind of outlook toward approaching a game. And it's really showed. I mean, his ERA is rock bottom compared to his record, really. He just hasn't gotten a lot of run support this year. But Danny Duffy is really going to be a spectacular pitcher, I think, in the years to come for the Royals once he gets this past his shoulder issue.
Yeah, we spoke, two or three weeks ago on this podcast, and we talked about Duffy's inning and Ventura's innings, and Duffy threw less than 100 innings last year, coming back from Tommy John. So maybe that does play into, the inflammation issues he's dealing with now. But we also talked about Ventura, who, between Triple A and the big leagues, was right around 150 innings last year. So you kind of wondered, would he hold up down the stretch? But he definitely has. I don't think that's the main question. His last seven starts dating back to July 31st, he has a 2.25 ERA, pitched six scoreless in the Bronx last Sunday. So that's been as big as anything for them, hasn't it, DK? Just Ventura holding up under the weight of the full season?
Yeah, Ventura seems very healthy, at least arm-wise. Now, he has had a little mid-back issue from time to time recently, but he seems to have gotten past that. The arm is sound. And this kid is really quite a competitor, he's going to be good like Duffy. With Ventura and Duffy in the years to come, I think you really got a pair to draw to there with the Royals' future. But as far as this year it goes, I think Ventura is going to be all right down the stretch. I think he's matured enough physically and mentally that he can handle it.
Yeah. And we talked about this before, too, how much they've relied on the big three in the back end of the bullpen. And Greg Holland has dealt with some triceps issues here, maybe even a little fatigue as well. Do you think maybe in the long run that this time off for him earlier this week is a good thing to get him kind of, get stabilized things there? But do you think he's going to be all right for them in the last couple weeks of the season?
I think so. I talked to Greg yesterday, and he seems to be fine. They're being very cautious. When you get that triceps elbow issue around in there, they're very careful. They want to be sure he's completely sound. As Ned says, if he says, I feel okay, but as Ned put it, so eloquently, then I'm not going to use him. if he's feeling the least a little achy, so they're gonna make sure Collins 100%.
I know. And speaking of Ned, I know this came up the other day. Just the idea of maybe moving Infante, moving somebody else into the number two hole, where Infante has batted all season. Infante's had some struggles in the second half, just getting on base. But I think that just speaks to the big question with Yost as we go down the stretch. Is they're struggling a bit offensively. How much do you tinker with things in the midst of that versus just, letting the lineup basically ride as it did in August when they were so hot? Where do you stand on that? Is it fair to just kind of ride things out the way it is? Do you think maybe some changes are in order? What's your sense of the offense at this point?
Well, Ned, as you know, wants to stick with the established lineup, and I think, he has a good point. Omar Infante was not hitting all that well, and then just the other day, after we discussed this, should Omar come out of that number two hole and maybe somebody else be plugged in there, that very night, Omar comes through with three hits at Detroit.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Ned's got a feel for these things, and as he says, Omar's got a simple swing, a good short swing, and he can come up with, boom, three or four hits for you almost any night. And, Omar is also one of these players that through the years has an uncanny knack of coming up with a big hit at the right time. So Omar is a guy he's gone with most of the season in that number two hole, and I think he's going to ride with him the rest of the way. And I think the rest of the lineup, too, is going to pretty stable. He does have some questions about Billy Butler in the DH spot, and should he use Josh Willingham there or Carlos Pagaro or this kind of thing, because Billy's been struggling a little. But that's just one question. As a whole, I think the lineup's going to be pretty stable as we go down the stretch here.
Well, that lineup will be needing some big hits down the stretch, and as we sit here today, the Tigers certainly appear to have the Royals' number head to head. But that weekend series coming up is going to be a big one. Could decide the Central, so the Royals can certainly atone for their earlier issues against the Tigers in a big way. So, I want to thank Dick Cagle for joining us. We're going to talk about the Detroit Tigers, who in that back and forth battle with the Kansas City Royals and. Tigers really took care of business in the home series against the Royals this week. They won the series and just further established their dominance of the Royals when they play head-to-head. Through the first 15 games of the season series, the Tigers had won 11 of the 15. So, if you could apply that winning percentage everywhere else, the Tigers would be running away with the division. But as it stands, the Royals have given them a real run for their money. And let's bring in Jason Beck to talk about that. Beck, when you watch these two teams head to head, I mean, is that ultimately? Do you think that's going to be the story of this division race? Is it just a more veteran, more proven team taking over against a team that hasn't been there, or obviously the Royals are going to be pesky all the way through, but I guess does the head to head really prove something about where these two clubs are at?
I think to some extent, yeah, I think that's part of the story. The Tigers played like a team that was used to being in these situations. And the Royals, you know, whether or not they felt the pressure, they look like they did. And if you talk to Tigers players, you know, a lot of them thought they saw signs that, that suggested the pressure was shifting from why aren't the Tigers in front by 20 games to are the Royals going to be able to hang on to this?
Right.
And I think, you know, just the little things, you know, like the pinch running thing, you know, the one night, Jared Dyson gets on. It's a clear sign that, that they're going to try something, and then he flinches. Or, you know, in the first game of that series, there were some key defensive miscues there. You know, stuff that not necessarily was scored errors, but just plays that in tight games, some of which you have to make to give your starting pitcher a chance, or at least a chance to catch his breath while he's getting an onslaught of doubles and singles. Just little things like that. And I think the Tigers sensed that, and I think that kind of contributed to a little bit of the killer instinct.
Yeah, and they had that killer instinct the week earlier with the Indians as well. The Indians were kind of playing themselves back into that division race almost inconceivably with all those young guys in their lineup, and then the Tigers really took care of business, winning 3 of 4 in Cleveland, and they'll have another chance to take care of business this weekend against Cleveland just to make sure that the Indians don't have another uprising. But, you know, the big news for the Tigers this week and what could be a big separator for them is getting their bullpen back whole with Joaquin Soria supposed to be activated midweek after, you know, dealing with the left oblique injury shortly after they acquired him in July. You know, Beck, I don't think you can put Soria directly in the closer's role after missing all that time, but you do have to think about, you know, Joe Nathan's overall struggles, his recent elbow soreness. Jabba Chamberlain has not been the same guy in the second half that he was in the first. Is this, do you think there's enough time left in the season where Soria might even take over that closer's role at some point, or is he better suited to the setup role? What are your thoughts on that?
I think if Joe Nathan goes south again, you know, maybe you see it. I think they like what they've been seeing out of Nathan recently. You know, he's throwing the ball better. You know, he's not necessarily pounding the strike zone a ton. You know, I think he's still kind of, you know, trying to pick out the corners a bit, but he's getting some success out of it, and he's not getting hit for those, like, massive, you know, base hits off the wall or over the wall or anything like
right.
that to the same degree lately. I think the bigger insurance that, that Soria provides is for Jabba. I think, you know, he hasn't fallen apart, but he's had just, you know, a little bit more struggles that make you go back and you look at the workload he's had to take on, you know, first of all, early in the year, but especially in the past month with, you know, with Soria out. And this gives you a chance to mix and match a little bit. This gives you a chance to give Jabba Chamberlain a game off here and there. You don't have to rely quite as much on him. You can kind of, you know, freshen him up to some extent for the postseason, and, you know, if they're fortunate enough to get there, and for the stretch run if this, you know, if this remains close.
You know, maybe this even frees them up offensively a little more, just mentally. I talked to some Tigers players when they were in Cleveland last week, and there was a sense among some of those guys, we got to score like 7 runs a game just to feel like, you know, the game is really in hand. The way their bullpen was going, it was, you know, just anytime a team is shaky in the back end of the bullpen, there's that effect on the rest of the club. You see that on starters, you see that in the offense, but, you know, Soria should help that quite a bit, but, you know, one guy, it always comes back to this guy offensively, Miguel Cabrera playing with now we know it's a bone spur in his right ankle. And, of course, that's the back ankle where hitters generate so much power. Now that we know what it is exactly, Beck, do you have an even greater appreciation for, you know, what this guy does offensively? He had a really rough August, but September he's come back exceptionally strong.
Yeah, it's kind of a reminder of what we saw down the stretch last year where he was playing through, I mean, basically a groin tear and still
right.
hitting, you know, not hitting for much power, but still hitting. Now you're starting to see that power come back really to all fields, although it seems like he's pulling the ball a little bit more now than he was. You know, this guy just, you know, he gets banged up. he gets worn down, and he makes adjustments to find ways to be productive, and that athleticism kicks in, and that explosive swing just, you know, gets tweaked and polished a little bit to where it's, you know, even if it's not ideal, it's workable. And for him, workable is, you know, better than most guys' ideal swing. So it's, yeah, I mean, it's as impressive as it was to watch the Triple Crown season and watching everything go right and watching this, you know, magical historic year come together. I think what he's done the last two late season stretches, you know, deserves a lot of recognition in its own right. And I don't think it's going to, you know, go down in history like that, but I think those of us who watched it are going to appreciate it down the line.
Yeah, and you talk about adjustments. I was watching him even more closely those first two games against the Royals once you knew it was the bone spur, and you do see he definitely made an adjustment in his balance and maybe even you know, trying to generate more power of that front foot than he normally would. But that guy can make adjustments with the best of them, no doubt about it. As they go forward, Jason, do you think what's the best way to handle first base? Is it just kind of what they're doing, just kind of mix and match him and V-Mart, really keep Mickey off his feet for a few days at a time? And Victor is obviously a defensive downgrade at this point in his career. You don't want to overdo it with him at first base, but you obviously want to keep Mickey off his feet when you can too.
Yeah, I think that's what they're going to have to do. You know, just you know, play them in two or three game stretches at first, and then, you know, swap them out, you know, between first and DH. It's not ideal, but it's pretty much, you don't have a whole lot of choice at this point. And I think, you know, with stretches like that, you know, Victor, I mean, you know him, you know, as well as anybody. He takes a lot of pride, you know, when he is out on defense. I think you can count on him to give you an honest effort out there at first, even if the body isn't always willing to do some of the things you got to do. You know, I think, you know, we saw it a little bit in the Kansas City series. He's reaching out like mad to try to get a throw and, you know, from the shortstop and get there before the runner hits the bag. You know, this is his time of year too. You know, he missed out on the World Series run in 2012. You could tell how much that pushed him in 2013. And right now, he's having enough of a contribution where I've got people asking me, you know, should Victor Martinez be in the MVP conversation? Well, it's tough to get a DH to really get a whole lot of serious recognition in there unless you're putting up David Ortiz tough numbers. But, you know, down the stretch, you know, he's not a full-time DH anymore. He's a part-time DH, part-time first baseman.
And yeah, he's tops in OPS and drove in 30 runs in August at a time when Miggy was really struggling. So I think he's definitely in the conversation. I don't know if you can put him ahead of Mike Trout, just knowing, you know, Mike Trout's impact on both sides of the ball, but I don't think it's all that crazy, frankly, to consider Victor, you know, at the forefront of that conversation. I think that's going to be an interesting thing to look at as we get towards the end of the season, at the end of the season and those votes are finally tallied. But so back in general, you feel that confidence, that veteran savvy kind of taking over in that clubhouse, did it ever waver at any point, in that rough August, or are you getting the sense that, you know, this team still has that, as you said, that killer instinct?
Yeah, I think it's there now. You know, whether it wavered, it kind of depends on who you ask. I've had a couple guys tell me that, you know, we always knew we were capable of this. It was just a matter of, you know, getting to that caliber of play at the right time. I've had other guys say that, you know, we went through a rough stretch, and, you know, there were times when the expectations hung over us. You know, talking with Joe Nathan, I mean, he got the definite sense that the pressure that they were dealing with all summer had shifted over to the Royals after, you know, winning the first couple of games of that series. I guess, you know, different guys observe pressure or detect pressure in different ways. But this is a team where I think to a man, that sense of pressure, if it was there, isn't there anymore. this is a team responded. And I think this is a team they expected to be, a lot of them anyways. And this is what brought them out. There were some guys who were waiting for the Royals to get into town so that they could show this type of play, because they felt that they had the caliber of play in, you know, to beat these guys up a little bit.
Well, that saying in baseball, that water finds its level, and you know, perhaps that's the case with the Tigers here, especially now that Soria is coming back and presumably patching up an area that has been such a source of instability for them this season. So I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us. I'm going to be joined by Jordan Bastian to talk about a Tribe team that made a late push in the AL Central, but they had some difficulty in early September that's really hampered their ability to make the AL Central title or to even make the playoffs for the wild card. They have still have a shot at in the last couple of weeks, but to do that, they're definitely going to need to get their bats going. They struggled quite a bit in the second half, and particularly the last month or so. Let's go ahead and Jordan talk about that. Jordan, you know, if the Indians had my Wahoo football team in our fantasy league, they'd be an offensive juggernaut, but they don't. They've had a lot of young guys in the lineup, you know, playing guys like Zach Walters and Tyler Holt quite a bit. Jose Ramirez obviously taken over at short for Asdrubal Cabrera, who's traded. The Nick Swisher injury, you know, create opportunities for Walters and Holt in particular. But is that finally caught up with them, you think, a little bit with, you know, so much youth in the lineup?
I think so. I mean, I think they've tried to balance competing and contending with developing. And through much of August, you know, it was working. You know, and some of those young guys were given the offensive spark, and the pitching was dynamic, which I think was really what the major reason was behind the Indians kind of staying right in the thick of things. But, you know, they've been kind of treading water for the last couple weeks, back to playing 500 baseball, and, you know, that's not going to cut it. They needed to go on a pretty hot run here in September, and they haven't been able to do that out of the gates. Dropping some games that, you know, really they should have won. Think to the opener in the series against the Twins, you know, facing a pitcher that, you know, they really should have been all over. Right-hander with a high ERA, not much experience. This is a guy that they should have really been able to jump on. And, you know, just weren't able to do it. And, you know, you can see this offense over the last 3 weeks or so, you know, has really been struggling. Or even back to about the start of August, you know, they've been scoring three runs or fewer in majority of their games, putting a lot of pressure on the pitching staff, which speaks to that pitching staff. It's, you can be complimentary about them, the fact that every inning, every pitch is high leverage, you know, because one mistake becomes extremely magnified. Again, back to that first game against Minnesota, Trevor Bauer, you know, holds the Twins to an 0-for-23 showing, except for a four-batter stretch where, you know, he lost it for four hitters, gave up four hits, gave up four runs, and it wasn't pretty for about 5 minutes. But that was it. That doomed the team for the whole game. So I think that's what's been going on with the offense. It's been really, really not even streaky anymore. It's just anemic, and it's really hurting a team that's been so reliant on pitching. And, you know, you could see the foundation maybe looks promising for the future, but, you know, I think after last season, Indians fans didn't want to look ahead to 2015. They wanted this year to be something that was built on what they were able to do last year, and doesn't look like Cleveland's going to be able to do that.
I think that that Bauer sequence you mentioned, I think it was like nine pitches, and yeah, you show that that really does illustrate the lack of room for error. And you know, you wouldn't be surprised if some of these young guys in the lineup are gripping the bats a little tighter, just knowing what's at stake and having never been in this experience before. But some of Walters in particular, for me, he fits that perfectly, because I don't know if I've seen this guy take a pitch yet. He's got a very aggressive mentality at the plate. I'm sure he's aware you can take pitches, but he hasn't really done much of that. Is he maybe the perfect example of a young guy thrust into a situation that, you know, maybe he's just not ready for at this point? I know he's hit some big home runs for them, but you know, that kind of mindset just isn't installed yet of patience at the plate and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is a guy that needs consistent at-bats, and the Indians were willing to give him that for the, you know, down the stretch since they acquired him and brought him up to the big leagues. But, you know, his slugging percentage has kind of held true through the minor leagues and translated to the big leagues, but he's not getting the other hits to fall, and that's the part of his game that, you know, he feels consistent at-bats are going to produce. But, you know, that, again, that's, we're talking about development, and this is a team that's supposed to be contending. So that's that balance they're trying to strike, and it becomes damaging when a guy is trying to develop something that he knows he needs repetition to get, you know, and the team's trying to stay in the thick of a playoff race at the same time. You know, you're taking a risk there by putting that guy in the lineup every day. At the same time, you're hoping he can give you a spark, and he has. He's had some, you know, awesome home runs and walk-off hits and, you know, things of that nature, but the consistency hasn't been there. That's where development comes into play, and that's where the offense has taken a hit, and that's why the Indians are where they are.
Yeah. Well, on the bright side, you know, a lot of division games left, obviously, and their pitching has kept them in games, aside from, you know, Danny Salazar had some struggles in the makeup game against the Angels, had some struggles. He struggled outright. He had a six-run fifth inning, and then, you know, those nine pitches from Bauer that we just mentioned. But aside from that, in general, their starting pitching has definitely kept them in the ball games. And think about Corey Kluber, and there was some worry about him, you know, battling fatigue and kind of losing his touch, but he rebounded from that in a big way. It was interesting to read your note talking to Mickey Callaway about, you know, what they did with Kluber in that last start against the White Sox. He really wanted to establish his fastball. I think you said in there it wasn't until his 31st pitch of the night that he finally threw a breaking ball. Is that I guess it's just, again, as we've seen the last couple of years, Mickey Callaway's, you know, magic touch with some of these pitchers really, you know, getting them to stick to their strengths in a lot of senses.
Yeah, and Carlos Carrasco fits that too, a guy that, you know, and you got to give credit to bullpen coach Kevin Cash there, who really preached that aggressive mentality, and that's translated to starting. And the thing that, you know, when we spoke to Callaway, and he really emphasized that the beginning of that game by Kluber, you know, where he only threw sinkers, and then he mixed in a cutter, which is still from the fastball family, so, you know, that's why, you know, it took to the 10th batter before he threw a true off-speed, you know, breaking ball. And he talked about how if a pitcher can do that, he should do it every time because it saves the breaking stuff for later in the game, and it makes that stuff more effective because you've established that fastball, you've pounded it early. And you could almost sense, like, he's kind of almost – that's almost a message to Bauer. You know, this is a guy that's thrown everything but the kitchen sink in the first inning this year while he's trying to figure out which of his pitches are on, and it's gotten him into some trouble early in games. And then when he does settle in – then he becomes effective and has had some really strong outings after he's given up four or five early in the game. So I think when Mickey talks about that, you know, they've stressed that to Carrasco, you know, to pound his fastball early, and you see him coming out now 97, 98, you know, right out of the gates. They've stressed it with Salazar to, you know, come out early, establish that fastball, and then all of a sudden that split change, you know, is much more effective late in games. And Kluber, who has the ability, because his fastball is so good, can go out there and kind of do it to be effective on his own, but you hope also it's a way for the other pitchers to kind of watch that and hopefully emulate it. And I think that's something that the Indians want to see. Mickey Callaway is really big on first-pitch strikes and on strikes in a 1-0 count. You know, and that's something he really talked a lot about when he came over and took the job. That was part of his presentation when he was trying to get the pitching coach job, was the percentage of success a pitcher has in those two situations. And, you know, you can see the results right now.
Yeah, he did this little game with Bauer before Bauer's last start in his side session, just hammering the consequences of not throwing those first pitch strikes. You know, you would have him throw a pitch, and if he didn't throw a strike with that first pitch, or if he did throw a strike with that first pitch, he was allowed to throw anything else in his repertoire, which is that seemed like a good way to get in the head of a guy like Bauer, who's so intellectual and has a deep arsenal and wants to use it, but sometimes overuses it or overthinks it early in games.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear Francona talk about that recently, because he used a buzzword from Bauer's Diamondbacks days, and that's stubborn. He said he's a stubborn kid. And, you know, as reporters, we kind of perked up a little bit because, hey, that's a word that kind of was looked at as a negative from his Arizona days, and one of the reasons Arizona wanted to get him out of there was because of this reputation for being stubborn and unwilling to be coached. But what Francona, he tried to flip it and say, no, like, this isn't necessarily a negative. It's one of the things that makes him good is the fact that he has found what he feels works for him, and it's finding a way to blend that with what the Indians see and what their analytics say. And one thing Francona said, which was also interesting, was with a lot of pitchers, the idea is to simplify things down to its basic form to try and find success or a way to hammer home a point. With Bauer, he said maybe the idea is actually to get more complex with him and to show him in a little more in-depth way why what they're trying to say will work. And maybe that's more of an approach that will convince Bauer to be less stubborn, if you want to use that word, that if he can see through the Indians' analytics that, hey, here's why we think you should do this, you know, maybe he's more adept for adaptation. So I think that's one approach they're taking with him, and you know, hopefully it works out in the long run.
Well, always work with the pitchers is a big reason why we're even talking about the Indians as a contender here down the stretch. And obviously they got to right the ship offensively. They got to have a definite sense of urgency there offensively in these final games. But I'm a little worried about the clubhouse mentality, not of the Indians, but of your Wahoo football team, which really took one on the chin on Sunday night with Julius Thomas going off for three TDs. Are you worried about your club bouncing back from that?
Yeah, you know, Lord F. Percy put up a good score in week one. You know, you can't count on Julius Thomas TDs every week, Anthony. I think, you know, you got a spark there, a good week one lift. I think your clubhouse got the morale high. But, you know, our guys are keeping their heads up high and know that they put up a score that would take down most teams every week. You know, we're fine.
Well, I'm penciling them, maybe not for three, but at least two a week. I'm figuring two touchdowns a week from Thomas, and I'm off and running. But I want to thank you all for listening to our fantasy football nonsense and our Indians banter as well. I want to thank Jordan Bastian for joining us. He's going to be joined by Scott Merkin and talk about a White Sox team that, no matter how much stock you put in my opinions, myself and some other people are starting to view as a nice little sleeper for 2015. The White Sox are starting to put some pieces together, and they'll probably have some money to spend this winter, so they'll be an interesting team to watch as we get into the offseason. But let's bring in Merk to talk about that. Scott Merkin, when he's not following Garth Brooks around or following the Eagles around, he occasionally goes to White Sox games. And
that was a great concert, by the way, Garth Brooks.
I'm sure it was life-changing. Not as life-changing as a Bruce Springsteen concert, which you refused to see, but
or the,
life-changing.
But, yeah, that's another podcast altogether, though, probably.
Absolutely. Merk, you talked to Rick Hahn earlier this week, and you know the White Sox, they have, what, about $45, $46 million tied up before you look at arbitration cases. That's obviously a low figure for 2015, and it seems like Rick's going to have some money to work with this winter. And I want to put you on the spot here. If you're Rick Hahn, how do you go about spending that money? Maybe not specific players, but what are your areas of emphasis, I guess, as you look to take this team to the next level?
Well, I think you need a left-hand. Well, you definitely need a left-handed bat to help protect Abreu and Avi Garcia in the middle of that order. And of course, the name that keeps popping up because of the fact that he's had an MVP caliber season and he's going to be a free agent is Victor Martinez. And you know, a great clubhouse guy, a great player, can play a little bit of first base too. And I think the Sox are looking for a guy who's not just a pure DH. You know, it doesn't have to be like a guy who, you know, can play 80, 90 games in the field, but a guy that if you need to put him out there can do it, and Victor fits that category. That's just an example. There are other options out there, but that's a name you hear that pop up a lot. You know, I think they need another, probably a right-handed starter. Now, the interesting situation for that one is, you know, you have Chris Sale and Jose Quintana, who are, you know, top two guys, and a pretty good top two, I'd say, match up against a lot of top twos in baseball. Then you have Carlos Rodon, who has a pretty good chance, or is being given the chance, I should say, before you even see him pitch next February, is being given the chance to break camp with the team as a third starter. And then you have John Danks, who's, you know, kind of falls in that good innings-eating category and can probably move himself up as, you know, depending on, you know, he's shown that he can be more than just a guy who throws 200 innings and has the 4.34 ERA. He's won 13, 15 games in a season, throws 200 innings. And Hector Noesi has done a great job at the back end of the bullpen, but are you going to go with that group? You know, it's kind of hard to trade John right now because of the fact that he's owed $28.5 million, somewhere in that range, in the last 2 years of his contract. So do you look and, you know, take a chance, a guy they really love, and Jose Quintana, but a guy who also would bring a huge return probably? you look and possibly explore trades involving him. So it'll be interesting how the rotation comes out. I think they're going to look for another catcher to go with Tyler Flowers, who's had a solid season and has proven that he can be an everyday type of player. But I think they'll probably look for maybe a left-handed hitting complement to him. And I would say, probably three relievers. You know, the bullpen has some nice young arms. Jake Petrischka, Daniel Webb come to mind right off the top of my head. But I would think they're going to look for some, you know, a couple relievers. And not necessarily a closer per se, although that could happen, but more veteran guys who can probably do both the setup and pitch in the ninth inning if needed. So there's a long list. And, again, Rick said this when they began this reshaping process last year, that it's not all going to happen at once, and it may not all happen this offseason. No one knows what the exact payroll is going to be until November. But I think they're going to make a significant move into that next step to fulfill that sleeper prophecy going into next year.
Yeah. Well, you just spent all their money, Mark. You just spent every last dime in that.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. I got it. Now, if it was just that easy, you know, unfortunately, it's not like free agency is not like day camp where you call dibs and you get it or something like that. So just because they like Victor Martinez doesn't mean that he's going to go there. Victor Martinez, I'm going to guess, is going to have more than one team offering him a solid deal in the offseason, including the one he is taking to the pub team, having to take the playoffs right now, the Tigers. So, yeah, but if it all works as I have it planned out, then Rick is set. Rick's going to have an easy offseason. He's just got to match the money to the players pretty much, and that's it.
Yeah. Well, one thing with Vic is the Tigers will be the only team that wouldn't have to fork over a draft pick to sign him, so that's going to be one issue in his market on top of his age. But he's certainly certainly proven himself adept at the plate, even at that advanced age. So that'll be interesting. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, Mark, and it's my fault. Let's stick let's stay in the present tense for just a minute now. They're trying to finish September strong. White Sox haven't had a winning September since 2010. And obviously in 2012, that loomed very large in the AL Central race with the Tigers. So, you know, I was talking to Jose Abreu last week about, you know, his season and where things stand with this club. And he said, you really got the sense that not only does he want to be great individually, he wants to be on a great team. And he even tweeted something to that effect after they came back to beat the A's earlier this week, said, "We're working hard to finish strong." Is that, Do you get that mindset from this club that they do want to kind of go out on a winning note here and charge into the offseason? Obviously, every club does, but is it a particular sense of urgency on the part of the White Sox, just given the way the last few seasons have gone?
Well, I would say it's kind of two parts. I don't know if it's urgency. I mean, every team, like you said, wants to win, and they want to win as many games as possible. But I think it's a little unfair to base their season on what they do in September because of the fact they are playing a lot of young guys. And guys who are call-ups and guys who are prospects. And this is really becoming kind of an evaluation period. And I know, fans don't want to hear that. They want to go out. They don't want to see a five-error game like they had against the A's. They want to see good baseball all the time. But this is all part of the process. And we're all fans of something or another, and it's kind of hard to rationalize or kind of come to terms with that maybe they won't win a ton of games this month. But they're looking at a guy like Andy Wilkins and seeing, is this a guy we can pencil in next year that can help us? And then maybe we don't have to, fill that spot through free agency or trade. We can allocate the money elsewhere. That's the biggest thing for Rick in the offseason is just, they have money to spend, but where do you allocate it in terms of biggest need? You're looking at second base with Carlos Sanchez and Marcus Semien. Micah Johnson was shut down with a hamstring injury, or he'd be there too. So, and, Chris Bass is getting a start against the A's. He's another guy, to check out. So there's all sorts of, Scott Snodgrass pitched in relief in the game where the Sox made five errors. So they want to win. It's important to go into next year, but I don't think it's important to go, 16-2 down the stretch as it is to see these guys play and really get an idea. And now again, it's just 1 month. You're playing against some good teams and some exceptional pitching, so it's not a completely accurate view. But you do get an idea. You do get a better idea seeing these guys play 25, 30 games than you do seeing them hit at Charlotte in a park that's, kind of a hitter's park, and not taking anything away from those stats, but you get a better view up here. So winning is important, always, yes, but I think playing good baseball and getting an idea of what these younger guys are about is more important to the White Sox.
Yeah. Well, the one guy I think all of us want to see finish strong, literally physically strong, is Paul Konerko, and he fractured that bone in his hand on a play in the field and hasn't played since as we sit here talking about this, but he vowed he'll finish on the field. He said it was encouraged enough by the uh, by the strides he's made with the hand that he'll at least get up there. You said even if he has to stand at the plate and take three pitches, he will bat at least one more time before all is said and done. But what's your overall gauge on Canerico's condition and you know his potential to finish the season strong?
I would think, you know, talking to him, Reese, I would think at the worst he probably plays a couple. The Sox finished with four games at home against Kansas City. So I think at the very worst case scenario, he plays a couple games. Then maybe he starts one game, and then that Sunday game to close the season, he goes out and plays a couple innings and gets the thunderous ovation as his last, you know, game as a major leaguer and as part of the White Sox. And, you know, he said, though, that's not his target. He wants to be back. He wanted to be back against the Twins this weekend. Not sure if that's going to be possible, but he's definitely looking at some point during the road trip where they go to Kansas City, Tampa, and Detroit, so he's not coming in cold for that Kansas City series. So Canerico's a pretty driven guy, and he's got a pretty high pain tolerance, so I think at some point in that road trip, maybe that Tampa series, which is the second of the three-game series, you see him play a game return. You know, he wasn't going to play every day anyway, so it's not like they're losing everyday play from him, but, you know, it's basically a question of maybe six or seven games versus three or four games because of this injury. I think that road trip seems realistic unless, you know, we haven't talked to him for a couple of days, so unless something has changed in that process.
When the injury was first reported and you read some things, it sounded grim as far as him being able to get back this season, but there's that kind of nagging thought that it's hard to imagine Paul Canerico's career ending like that. You definitely get the sense he's going to do everything he can to get back on the field.
Yeah, I don't think he would let it end like that. Like, you know, like you said, unless it really was just, you know, I think even if, as he pointed out, even if he comes up and pinch hits in a game and takes three strikes and sits back down, he'll get out there. But I really do think he's going to be able to get out there and play, you know, geez, at least, like I said, a game and some change in that final game. You know, even if it's, you know, partial games in Saturday and Sunday. Saturday, the 27th is Paul Canerico Day, and that's the big ceremony honoring him that night before the game against the Royals. So maybe he plays half of that one and then plays a few innings Sunday, and that's it. That, I would think, again, is the worst-case scenario. But he's got drive like few other, and I've seen him overcome, you know, a lot. I've seen him get hit in the face in a game by Carl Pavano by a pitch and then get a home run two at-bats later. So you don't count anything with Paul Canerico. If he says this next road trip, I believe he'll be out there the next road trip.
Well, yes, we'll see. It's the end of the line for Paul Canerico. We want to definitely wave him off well, and the White Sox will welcome in a 2015 season where they can definitely be an interesting team to watch, especially with some money to spend this winter, and even though Merck just spent every last dime of it in this podcast. So I want to thank Scott Merkin for joining us. Talk about a Twins team that, while obviously out of the playoff picture this season, has definitely shown a lot of signs of life offensively, and that's a big deal for the Twins. Kenneth Vargas has been a big part of that. He was actually, interesting note on him, he was the only two guys quicker to 40 hits and 30 RBIs in their career were two names you've probably heard of, Joe DiMaggio and Albert Pujols. They did it in 32 games. Vargas reached it in 36 games. So he's a big, big piece for them going forward in the middle of the order. And another important piece for them going forward is Brian Dozier, who really rose up the ranks and had a big spring a couple of years ago to get on the Major League radar. And, since then really established himself at second base. He had a nice season, huge season for them, 20 home runs, 20 stolen bases, 30 doubles, really established himself among the elite offensively at second base, a position where so many teams struggle to find that kind of output. So Brian Dozier at 27 has really become an interesting piece for the Twins, and also become the Heart and Hustle Award winner for the Twins this season. And our own Rhett Bollinger talked to him recently about that honor, about his season, about the direction of the Twins offense. And here's their conversation.
Heart and Hustle.
Yeah, so what's that mean to you?
Yeah, it means a lot. It's it's pretty cool. Yeah, receiving it before the game today. You know, it's voted on by the alumni and stuff. For them to see that in me is pretty cool. That's, I have a lot of respect of how you're supposed to play the game and stuff. And I don't know, take a lot of pride in that aspect of it. If you have heart, then you hustle, I guess, so to speak. We're getting really deep here, huh? it's a really, really cool award, to be honest with you. It's I think ever since I was little, got to play the game the way it's supposed to be played. Twins do a good job preaching that here, and there's a lot of guys and well deserving of that award. I just happen to be the one this year. So,
seems like in years past, a lot of leaders in this clubhouse, from Jamie Carroll to Michael Kadire, have won that award. What does that mean to kind of be in that kind of company?
Yeah, obviously, you just mentioned Jamie Carroll and Kadire. That's two of the best, in my opinion, that I've been associated with, of playing the game the way it's supposed to be played, and they were leaders in the clubhouse. And to be honest with you, I've always enjoyed taking on that kind of role, I guess, of a leader and that kind of thing. And you know, I've never really thought of, you know, that it comes with how much time you have or anything and all that kind of stuff. I feel like you gain respect by the way you play from guys in your locker room, and that's what I try to do every day. So,
what about this team? It seems like obviously struggles, but even when you guys are out of a game, so when you guys get back in it, just pops some tough losses recently. But
yeah, it's been frustrating. I feel like when we're hitting, we're not pitching, and playing D, and when vice versa, when we're pitching, we're not really getting hits and stuff. And but to say the least, I know I can speak for the offensive side of the ball. I feel like we've really come a long way this past 2 months or so, as far as driving people in, getting people on base. I mean, it's not really sure. I don't know if I can pinpoint anything of why that's happened. I know we obviously with Kenny's coming to the lineup and a big bat in the middle of the lineup, and a lot of guys stepping up and, you know, growing pains and stuff at the beginning of the season, and kind of turned the second half around. And it was obviously, and Danny doing what he's doing. I know from the offensive side of the ball, it's I feel like we're pretty good. So.
What's been your impression so far of Kenny specifically then?
You know, you see guys come up with, you know, being a rookie and stuff, that, you know, even guys that have good first 2 months or whatever, like Kenny's had, that they don't really have a plan or whatever, that you can see that they're still going to have to adjust and stuff. But something seems different with Kenny. I feel like he's using the whole field, not really swinging at too many pitches out of the zone and stuff like that. He seems like he's got a plan up there. He's not really just trying to hit every ball 600 feet. That he knows what he's doing, and especially when you get runners in scoring position, not trying to do too much, you know, with a lousy little single do the job and stuff. He kind of gets it already. It's pretty cool to see.
With the offense doing well it has recently, do you feel like that's something you guys can build on for next year in a sense?
Yeah, you know, we can always get better, obviously, but you know, going into the offseason and stuff and looking at what we did the last couple of months or whatever, and even the first month, I know we had a bad June and July or whatever, but I feel like what we're doing now is top of the league, to be honest with you, and that's something to build off of going into the offseason for sure.
Key pretty much next year, just put it all together with the pitching and the hitting.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's kind of evident of what we need. Need a few pitchers, a few pieces pitching wise. Need maybe another couple pieces hitting wise to be that complete team that can contend. And you see it around the league that even the team we're playing on, the Angels right now, they pretty much got it all. And how consistent they are, pitching, defense, and hitting. And I think we're very, very close.
Okay, I want to thank Rhett Bollinger for doing that interview with Brian Dozier. I want to thank Brian, obviously, for participating. All right, that's a wrap. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I want to thank all of our beat writers for joining us. This has been MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition.